Hello, you're watching the Light Novel's brief video series on the theology of the body. This video is dedicated to audience 42. So we first want to take a step back and look at what is JP2's method for analyzing Matthew chapter 5 verses 27 to 28. So he breaks up this verse into three pieces and begins, "You have said, or you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery." This part of the analysis was audiences 35 through 37. And that's where we talked about the sixth commandment in terms of kind of the historical development of its understanding of legislative, prophetic interpretations. And then we have the next part, "But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to desire her," that's audiences 38 through 41. That include talking about the wisdom tradition. Then we have "has committed adultery in the heart." And that is our this audience and the next one, audiences 42 and 43. And so some points concerning interpretation. Each of these three pieces has its own content, but they are all interconnected. The three pieces help explain each other. And some elements of the text then that JP2 points out is you have this component of committing adultery, you have this desiring, then we have this distinction between adultery in the heart and adultery in the body. So we have kind of four pieces going on here. We talked about in the first or in audiences 35 to 37, this idea of committing adultery in terms of the sixth commandment. Then we talk about the concept of desire. And now for audience 42, 43, we are going to look at this distinction between adultery in the body and adultery in the heart. All right. So some further comments now. So Christ is building up a new ethos with his Sermon on the Mount, and this requires a rediscovery of the values that were lost in the general understanding of the Old Testament ethos, especially concerning the sixth commandment. And we can note that the statement, "you shall not commit adultery," is a categorical norm. And we will talk more about what do we mean by categorical norm later on in this video. Now, this phrase, "whoever looks," shows us that this new ethos is something that is to be lived interiorly primarily. It begins within the heart of man. And this phrase "has committed" is a key expression for discerning the correct ethical meaning and source of the values in this new ethos that Christ is delivering on a Sermon of the Mount. So in the last slide, we introduced this concept of the adultery of the heart. And so now we have to ask the question, how do we reconcile the meaning of the committing adultery in the heart? We can quite easily understand that adultery in the flesh, because that's this exterior action, that conjugal union between the man and the woman who are not married to each other. But how do we reconcile that with this adultery of the heart? And that's going to take us into our audience. So understanding the adultery of the heart. So adultery is defined as the conjugal union of a man and woman who are not married. And this is a sin of the body tied to the external action and the state of life of the man and the woman. This action is inappropriate to the state of life of the man and the woman, and hence they are not morally authorized to unite conjugally. That's to say, since they're not married, they cannot do this act. They cannot perform the act that establishes the conjugal union. And so, interesting point that JP2 draws to our attention is the fact that Jesus Christ does not indicate whether the woman that the man looks at and desires and commits adultery in his heart with doesn't indicate whether the woman's actually married or not. The text of Matthew 5 does not tell you whether or not the woman is married. And this raises a rather interesting question. Is this look of desire evil only in the case when the woman is not one's wife? Or is it also inappropriate to look at one's wife with this desire? And this question is actually going to help us answer the first question concerning the meaning of the adultery of the heart. So, continuing on. So, there's an argument now that is put forth in favor of, yes, you can look at the woman with this desire. So, and we've broken down to four premises here. So, first, only a man who is a potential subject of adultery of the body can commit adultery of the heart. That is to say, in order for a man to become an adulterer in the body, like if man is able to become an adulterer in the body, then he can become an adulterer in the heart. So there's kind of an equal, or I guess not to say equality, but they are circumscribed by each other. Right, the if man cannot come into adultery exteriorly through physical action, then he cannot have this adultery of the heart. That's what this first premise is saying. Now, when we move on to the second premise, this does not refer to a husband with respect to his wife, but only in regards to a woman who is not the man's wife, because it's only this. Only in the case of the unmarried woman that man can commit adultery of the body. And so only the husband could have the exclusive right to look at the wife with desire and not commit adultery in the heart. And so we kind of have this conclusion then that by virtue of marriage, one has the right to the conjugal union. And so by definition, cannot commit adultery in the heart, since it is impossible to commit adultery in the body. And this is an argument that seems that on the face of it seems to be rather convincing. It appears to satisfy the sixth commandment of not committing adultery. It has a neat kind of logical consistency to it. However, JP2 is going to say, even though this does appear consistent with the sixth commandment, JP2 is going to have some reservations because of Christ's words. And so he just makes a point that in order to analyze the situation correctly, we have to morally evaluate the concept of desire within the perspective of the dignity of the human person. That is to say, we have to look at this concept of desire from the perspective of the value of the person. And this is going to be key to understanding the adultery of the heart. And we have to wait until the next audience to figure out what is JP2's view on the matter. Guillermo, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Did you have anything you'd like to add at this point?
You know, I'm afraid I'd be jumping the gun.
Okay.
Yeah. Not just yet.
Okay. Does that mean you want to save it for later this audience or for the next one?
Let's say for the next one. If I see that the slides are. Oh, okay. Yeah, we could.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I try to hide. Whatever's about to happen from this audience. So
perfect.
Keep the listener in suspense.
Awesome.
Viewer, whoever.
Cool.
Whether you're watching or just listening. Yeah. Comments on Immanuel Kant. Plot change. So I want to return now to this concept of categorical norm. And to understand it, we're going to turn to Immanuel Kant, who was a famous Enlightenment philosopher. He was a German. And he was alive from 1724 to 1804. And he's famous for beginning the school of German idealism. And so the concept of the categorical norm begins really with Kant's ethics. So Kant makes a distinction between what he calls a hypothetical norm or a hypothetical imperative versus the categorical norm or the categorical imperative. So the hypothetical norm or the hypothetical imperative is a course of action, is a course of action as a means to achieving something else. So it's only good in the degree the action is a means to the end. So in this case, you have a norm that is a norm in order to obtain the end. So if I want to, I guess, cook dinner, I need to have clean pots and pans. So cleaning pots and pans in order to cook dinner is kind of a norm for doing that. Okay. It's conditioned by what is the thing you're trying to achieve. So a hypothetical norm has these conditions in based on the fact that they're means to obtaining an end. A categorical norm, on the other hand, is a course of action that is itself necessarily regardless of any conditions. It is something that is good in of itself. So a categorical norm, we could think of something like the case of, I guess, just don't commit adultery, right? The good in of itself is the human person. That is a categorical norm, not to commit adultery, because you violate the good of the other person and the good of the spousal meaning of the body and the good of the communion of persons when you commit adultery. Now, it's important to note that with Kant, there are influences of Kant within JP2's work. In fact, in the 1950s, JP2 spent a lot of time engaging with three philosophers, Immanuel Kant, Max Scheler, and St. Thomas Aquinas. There's several essays where he talks about the three, what they did correctly and where are their flaws, to try and discern what is the truth about ethics and what did they get right and wrong. And one of the most important concepts to come from Kant's ethics is that the human person is an end himself. The human person is never a means, but always an end. So the human person possesses a value that is intrinsic to him being a person. And so for Kant, there is this categorical norm that you cannot treat persons as means, but only as ends. And this concept is one of the foundational ideas of the entire theology of the body, that you cannot treat people as ends, you need to treat them as ends. This is a categorical norm. The value of the human person is the good in of itself that we are defending when we say that, no, you should not commit this adultery of the heart, whatever it is that we have started talking about and will continue talking about in the next audience. So, and this is really something that Kant had this powerful insight into the nature of ethics. And so, let's see here. We have this lovely quote. Would you like to read it, Guillermo?
Yes, I would. I quote, "But supposes that there were something the existence of which in itself had absolute worth, something which, as an end in itself, could be a ground of definite laws. In it, and only in it, could lie the ground of a possible categorical imperative. Now I say man, and in general, every rational being exists as an end in itself and not merely as a means to be arbitrarily used by this or that will. In all his actions, whether they are directed toward himself or toward other rational beings, he must always be regarded at the same time as an end. Rational beings are designated persons because their nature indicates that they are ends in themselves, in parentheses, i.e., which may not be used merely as an end. Things which may not be used merely as means, end parentheses. Such a being is thus an object of respect, and as such restricts all arbitrary choice. Such beings are not merely subjective ends whose existence as a result of our action has worth for us, but are objective ends, in parentheses, i.e., beings whose existence is an end in itself, end quote. Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals.
Oh, thank you, Guillermo. It's a magnificent quote by someone that normally Catholics just hate.
I can't say that I like him. I don't. But this, this is gold.
This is gold from someone that you should not like their philosophy. Which is interesting. So, Guillermo, go ahead.
Yes. Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Yes.
Well, as I said in the previous slide, he began what's called German idealism. Mm-hmm. And German idealism is the view that there is not an objective reality that is mind independent. So, like, the idealists believe that, I guess for Kant, he makes a distinction between what he calls the noumena and phenomena. And man, through the senses, only experiences phenomena, the appearances, but not the things themselves. And so you kind of have a idealist skepticism in some respect. So things like space and time, or the various categories of being, are actually ideas within man's mind to order appearances to give them coherence. So man's mind does not get you the things that exist in of themselves. You just get appearances, and the mind orders those appearances.
Okay. So would it be fair to say that it's when it comes to my exterior reality, it's me imposing reality on the things, not the things on me?
Essentially, it is
okay.
It is your brain and how it's developed with these basic ideas or forms that impose order on the appearances. So you do not perceive the things themselves. You just have the perceptions of things, and you order the perceptions of things with your mind. So the thing itself, that might be a tree or human nature, is outside of your ability to know. You can't know things themselves, but you can know appearances.
That's weird, because you would think that that's kind of like in not relativism. Something else comes to mind, but it almost sounds like, well, nothing's real. But and yet, okay, we can all agree that there's this chair sitting right here, and it's this color, it's this height, it's this heavy. But that's not really objectively true. It's just our impression.
Right.
Imposing our impression on it, but we don't really know
that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A classic question would be, how do you know that you see the same red chair I do? Maybe I see a blue chair and I'm just calling it red.
It makes you wonder how he came up with this, because he didn't come up with this on his own, right? I mean, I would think,
well, he studied a lot of the philosophers, including like Leibniz, Hume, Descartes, Some of the scholastics, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Hume, I could never understand. And as I've shared with you, I'm not very literate with the philosophy post-scholasticism, I suppose.
Yeah. I had a time when I was interested in Kant and I read a few of his books.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
For our listeners, this is just a bit of what Kant says. And, well, look, here's a grain of truth in this quote.
Yeah.
In the end, he's someone we should be rightly critical of.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're interested in reading Kant, I would actually highly recommend the book Foundations of the Metaphysics of Morals. Also, it's also translated as Groundwork for the Metaphysics of Morals. Something just a comment on Kant's ethical views here is you have this resounding defense of the human person as an end of, in of himself, as a value that has that is the ground for categorical norms. Now, the interesting thing for Kant and his ethical theory is that he'll take this content and he puts it within the mind of the human person. So because he is an idealist, in order to get the kind of necessity required for behind this categorical imperative, he's going to put it within the mind of the human person. And so human reason becomes the ground for measuring ethical norms, whether it's actually an ethical norm, whether it's good or evil. Human reason is the measure for ethics. And so there's this kind of tension between within Kant between this resounding defense of the human person that we just read and this kind of view that collapses morality to reason. And that's kind of what Kant does, is he collapses everything to reason. Whether it's aesthetics, ethics, metaphysics, you name it, he collapses it all down to reason. And that's really what his philosophical project is. He's famous for writing three critiques, the critique of pure reason, the critiques of practical reason, and the critique of judgment. The critique of pure reason focuses on, you could probably imagine, you know, philosophy, metaphysics, theology. Practical reason is on ethics, and the critique of judgment is on aesthetics. And all these he's going to essentially reduce to human reason. And that just because that follows from his commitment to idealism. So there are flaws with Kant's ethical theory, but here we can take a moment and admire his insight into reality concerning the human person as a source for categorical norms because of the human person possessing intrinsic value and dignity. Guillermo, did you have anything else you'd like to add?
I do not.
Okay. I believe that is the end. So with that, thank you for watching our video. If you have been enjoying our content, please subscribe, like, share, and comment on our social media. We have various social media platforms, including things like YouTube and Facebook. If you have been enjoying our content, we also ask that you please support us financially through a nice donation, either through Patreon or PayPal. Your financial support goes towards the maintenance of our website and the purchase of resources so that we can provide great materials for you, like our video series on the theology of the body and our articles on our website. Our website, lenovelesprit.com, has many scholarly articles for you to read for free and enjoy. We also have our podcast, and Guillermo can give you some more information about that.
Yes, in our other podcast series, we talk about a variety of topics, such as trends in culture and politics, and we always address those topics through a Catholic personalist perspective. We upload our episodes onto Buzzsprout.com, and you can locate our page on Buzzsprout using the La Novella Esprit website under the podcast category. And once you do so, you can listen to us directly on Buzzsprout, or you can use Buzzsprout to locate us in other popular podcast platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify.
All right. And just to clarify, if you are, you can find all of our social media at lanovelaesprit.com/subscribe. That's our Facebook, YouTube, whatever else, our how to support us financially, whether it's PayPal, Patreon, all of our website platform distributions for our podcast. And also there you can subscribe to our emailing list. Guillermo, do you have any last things for our audience?
I would just like to ask our viewers and listeners to keep us and our mission in your prayers.
Yes, please pray for us. And with that, we will see you next time.
Bye, everyone. God bless.